I'm Elaine Petro.
And I'm Mason Peck.
This is Spaceflight Mechanics, the Cornell Space Tech Podcast.
Elaine, we are lucky to have you at Cornell as our go-to person for space propulsion questions. You haven't let us down yet, but do you ever feel like you don't have all the answers? Like, if you feel that way, what do you do?
Well, thanks, Mason. It's good to feel appreciated. I'm very excited about my field, and I've certainly have gained a sense of the broad challenges, but I'm not an expert in all aspects, and nor is my group working on all of the interesting problems in space propulsion. Just on the electric propulsion side alone, there are many great research groups across the country and abroad, and many of these groups have been my role models for getting into the field. In fact, one is visiting us at Cornell this week. Professor Christina Limmer is a world expert in spacecraft electric propulsion and leads some really cool work out of Western Michigan University.
Let's chat with her.
Can you tell us what you do as a faculty member?
I am a professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, Michigan. I specialize in spacecraft propulsion and plasma dynamics. I teach courses related to those topics, spacecraft propulsion with a specialty in electric propulsion. I have a research lab, Aerospace Laboratory for Plasma Experiments, and I also mentor a CubeSat team through the Western Aerospace Launch Initiative, which is a student organization.
Maybe we could start by talking about what are some of the problems affecting space propulsion that you and your research group are currently working on?
The LP lab is devoted to plasma dynamics and electric propulsion systems. So we are looking at Hall effect thrusters, gridded ion thrusters, electrospray thrusters, and components of those types of electric propulsion devices. We are looking at fundamental physics problems associated with those types of thruster systems and how to measure plasma properties within those systems.
Now, we could take a week to talk about this, but let me ask about those three types of thrusters. Could you sort of outline what they do, what they're different, or how they're different from each other?
So all three of those thrusters are what are considered electrostatic thrusters, which means that they use electric fields to accelerate ions to produce thrust. The main difference is the mechanism of ionization for those thrusters. Gridded ion thrusters, or GITs, use electrostatic acceleration through two grids with a potential difference between them. So the ions are formed within the thruster using electron impact ionization, and then those ions are extracted out the thruster through the grids. The potential difference between those grids dictates the acceleration potential of the ions. Hall thrusters use the same mechanism of ionization, electron impact ionization. However, the electrons enter a toroidal channel where ionization occurs. And then a potential difference between an anode that lies at the back of that channel and just the downstream general potential causes the acceleration of the ions. And then electrospray thrusters are quite different. They don't have a mechanism of ionization. Rather, they extract either anions or cations. And the potential difference between an extractor point and a downstream grid causes the acceleration, similar to a gridded ion thruster.
So in these propulsion systems, we're talking about ions and electrons, right? So the ions are what used to be molecules, and something is stripped off some electrons, right? You're saying in the Hall thruster, it's electrons that are fired at the atoms, whatever those are.
Xenon.
Okay. And then those electrons strip off other electrons. So now we're left with these ionized xenon atoms. So they have an electric charge on them.
Mostly xenon, but yes.
And then in the gridded ion propulsion system, same idea. The only difference is that in a gridded system, it's the ions that get accelerated across a grid as opposed to through a channel and then out.
Correct.
Got it.
So which of these propulsion systems are you most excited about in the next decade or so?
Ooh, that's a good one. So gridded ion thrusters and Hall effect thrusters have a pretty well-established flight heritage. In fact, the Starlink satellites from SpaceX all use Hall effect thrusters operating with krypton, and they are now doing research to create one operating with argon. That being said, there's still a lot of things that we don't understand about Hall effect thrusters, and Hall effect thrusters have been targeted as one of the potential propulsion systems to take humans to Mars. So that's really exciting. Electrospray systems are less well-established. They are still in their infancy as far as being used for space propulsion techniques, and that's also really exciting.
Let's try to take that apart just for a second. So for the ion propulsion systems you were describing earlier, you're talking about noble gases, right? So xenon, argon, krypton. First, why use those kinds of gases as opposed to something else?
The noble gases are great because they have relatively low ionization energies, but also they are not molecules, so they will not split apart. So you don't waste energy breaking a molecular bond. Rather, all of the energy goes into ionizing the propellant.
So does it help that they're not reactive in a particular way?
That's also very important.
It seems helpful that you're not, let's say, trying to accelerate some particles through a thruster that also then want to react with the walls of the thruster.
That is true. Molecular oxygen is quite reactive, so we try to avoid that as much as we can with the walls of the thruster. Iodine is another propellant that has been talked about and tested, but iodine is also highly reactive to pretty much anything it touches. So that causes issues. But there is a lot of research going on into alternative propellants, especially as opposed to xenon, because xenon is very, very expensive.
So you were talking about electrospray, right? So for electrospray propulsion, what's the type of propellant that you use? Do you still use noble gases?
No. For electrospray thrusters, they use a different type of propellant. The idea behind an electrospray thruster is that you have a liquid meniscus that then forms what's called a Taylor cone or a very sharp peak. And from that pyramid, essentially, the ions or molecules are extracted. There are metallic propellants, so metallic ions will be extracted. That's one option. And then there are ionic liquid propellants. And an ionic liquid is a molten salt that is loosely correlated. So you have a negative molecule and a positive molecule that are attracted to each other. And then depending on how you're extracting them, you're either taking off the anion or the negative particle or the cation, which is the positive particle. Which I always get those confused. Is that right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay. I always remember.
I think cathode is negative.
And I always remember anion has an N, so it's negative.
Okay. Well, see, cathodes are the negative.
They produce negative particles. Yeah. Yeah.
So that should be the negative, but it's not.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, cations are known for shedding fur, is the main difference, I think, right?
I don't know.
They shed a lot of fur. They also make noises in the middle of the night. You got to clean up after them. Yeah.
Yeah. So the ionic liquids are quite complex molecules. One of them is called EMIBF4.
Do you want to go through the chemical formula?
I do not want to go through the chemical formula.
I don't think anyone wants that right now.
EMI is the positive cation, and BF4 is the negative anion. And so either one of those particles would be extracted.
That's a lot more effort, it sounds like, than using noble gases. Seems that there's a lot of additional chemistry involved. Is that true? I mean, is there more, what's the word, more kind of engineering necessary to make an electrospray thruster work instead of a, let's say, a thruster based on a noble gas?
Not necessarily. It's quite a simple technique, actually. The work goes into the chemistry behind developing of the propellant. The engineering as far as extracting the molecules is just which polarity you're operating your thruster with. So whether you're extracting with a positive polarity to extract cations or a negative polarity to extract anions. The reason that we extract both of them rather than just a single molecule is because if you are only extracting positive charges from the spacecraft, your spacecraft will charge to a negative potential. And if you are only extracting negative charges, your spacecraft will charge to a positive potential. This can cause damage to spacecraft components, and it can also cause issues with the propellant. If you are only extracting one of the molecules, the propellant can degrade.
So what do you do then to prevent that?
So we switch polarities. So a traditional ionic liquid electrospray system has a switching circuit. So you switch between extracting cations and extracting anions at about a rate of between 1 to 5 hertz.
So you're leading Western's first CubeSat project. Can you tell us the name of the CubeSat and its mission?
So yes, the CubeSat is called the Performance of Electrospray Propulsion for Gathering Single Polarity Data. Its acronym is PEPGS. We had to change the mission, so the name used to actually make sense. No, it doesn't. The acronym used to make sense. We just didn't change the acronym.
I gotta say, just as an aside, I'm not a fan of acronyms that spell out things. I mean, there's rarely a point to spelling them out. And often it spells out stuff that's just not quite appropriate. Like it'll spell out the word Icarus, right? Do we really want to name a spacecraft after some guy who's too stupid not to fly close to the sun and melt his wings? You know, that seems like a bad choice.
Don't even get me started on the Janus acronym.
Right. Anyway,
spacecraft love acronyms. So PEPGS. And It doesn't really spell on anything. It was just easier to say. So the purpose of the experiment is to fly a thruster in low Earth orbit, an electrospray thruster in low Earth orbit, and determine whether we can operate on single polarity mode. We're expecting degradation in the propellant, so a lower efficiency, but that would be compensated for by an easier circuit for the power processing unit for the thruster. To mitigate spacecraft charging, we are hoping that the ionosphere will do that for us. So the mission is to fly a single polarity electrospray thruster, and we will have a Langmuir probe attached that will measure the potential of space with respect to the potential of the spacecraft, so we can determine spacecraft charging effects. We're also going to measure the ion number density at the location in space, so we can correlate the ionospheric density with the spacecraft charging.
Now, I don't know much about plasma. One thing I know is there's a thing called a sheath or a Debye sheath, right? So your Langmuir probe presumably measures the potential beyond that sheath. Is this correct?
Our Langmuir probe is going to be mounted on a boom to get it outside of the sheath of the spacecraft. And because the spacecraft may be charging up to very high potentials, around 800 volts, because that's the potential at which we're operating the electrospray thruster, our boom is quite long, up to a meter and a half.
So long for a CubeSat, which is normally the size of a loaf of bread or something, right?
Two loaves of bread. We're okay. Doing a 6U.
A large artisanal country loaf of bread. All right. So the Debye sheath there, the idea there is that the charged body, so the spacecraft in your case, wants to attract the opposite charge to it, but those oppositely charged particles have too much energy just to kind of glom onto the surface. So they hover around it, I guess. Is that the way it works?
Because it depends on the energy of mm-hmm. the particles. So it's this balance between their incoming energy and the repulsive force or the attractive force.
So you have this cloud of oppositely charged particles around the spacecraft, and you need the boom to move the Langmuir probe outside of that so that you can independently measure.
Correct.
Gotcha.
So can you talk about the deployment of the boom? Is that a big event for the spacecraft, or is it pretty mundane?
We're working with a company called MMA to provide us with a deployment mechanism. Deployment of booms of that length is not unheard of. So it shouldn't be a huge event, but we are nervous about it because, you know, any deployment mechanism on a CubeSat can be failure.
Well, it sounds like an exciting technology demonstration almost. I can imagine other CubeSats might want that same capability.
Yeah, so the goal is there are new regulations that all satellites after end of life have to deorbit within 5 years. And this means that almost every satellite is going to have some sort of active deorbit mechanism. So this could be used as a very simple active deorbit mechanism for spacecraft.
So in the case of this technology demonstration, you'll measure charge to understand something about the electrostatic state of things. Are you going to propel the spacecraft and judge success on the basis of changing the orbit in any way?
Yeah, so we are planning to measure thrust by holding the spacecraft steady with reaction wheels while we impart a spinning momentum on it. And then we will measure the reaction wheel response to that.
That's a great idea. So even though the thrust might be very low, you'll see the torque show up as it integrates up into the wheel's angular momentum.
Exactly.
So are these off-the-shelf components you're buying?
The thrusters are actually a partnership with the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Dr. Paolo Lozano is providing those thrusters for us. The boom is an off-the-shelf component. We are developing the power processing unit and the Langmuir probe at Western Michigan University. And we are purchasing other components for the satellite, including the electrical power system, the attitude determination and control system, the communication system.
Does the spacecraft normally not spin, or is it generally spinning? You mentioned a spin-up maneuver, but is that unusual for your operations concept? In other words, do you start non-spinning, then become spinning?
So all CubeSats have different operational modes, depending on what the required mission is. For us, we are going to try to keep our spacecraft from spinning most of the time because of that really long boom that's going to be sticking out actually the side of the spacecraft. So the boom will likely not be in the direction of flight. So if we don't control the spin on the spacecraft, that could cause the spacecraft to start tumbling uncontrollably with the boom sticking out.
I see. I was thinking about other spacecraft that do plasma measurements. So magnetospheric missions like RBSP, right, the Radiation Belt Storm Probes, those are notably spinning spacecraft that have electrical probes on them, and they spin around. And in spinning, they keep the probes stuck very far out. I can't remember how far. It's quite far. It tends to maybe hundreds of meters. And then in the process, that spin also maintains the attitude. So I thought there was kind of like a history of spinning for these kinds of probes.
Huh.
And I'm just kind of curious about different approaches to it.
Yeah, I have no idea about that.
I guess you would need two probes. So you had I think. Would you need two probes to...
To balance it, yeah.
I suppose it depends what you're after.
But so, to keep it steady, if you're spinning, you would have to have two probes.
I suppose you could just spin around a point that's not exactly in the center of mass of the spacecraft. But in any case, just kind of curious whether that's useful for your approach. It sounds like, anyway, your architecture is one where it's not spinning, typically. And you maintain that with reaction wheels?
Correct. And magnetorquers.
Gotcha. When do you expect to launch this?
We are part of the University Nanosatellite Program through the Air Force Research Lab at Kirkland Air Force Base. We are coming up on the flight selection review in January. And so we are currently in what's called Phase A of this program. And Phase A, it's a two-year program where you go through initial spacecraft design. We have reviews with the Air Force Research Lab Small Satellite Portfolio Office. We refine the design and we start selecting components, purchasing components, and building a flatsat or an engineering model of the satellite. In January, we will find out whether we are selected for flight. So that's coming up soon. And if we are selected for flight, it's usually a 2 to 3 year process after that.
Can I ask what the budget is that they're providing for this?
Phase A budget is $220,000.
Is your flat sat actually flat or does it have the geometries?
We have a 3D printed model of the spacecraft and then all of the components are laid out next to that 3D printed model. So sort of flat.
I guess it's flat just in the sense that it can lay on a desktop.
Yes.
And the components are not trying to be integrated into the full spacecraft structure.
Correct.
How many students are involved in this project?
So the student organization that houses the CubeSat project has about 80 students. We have about 30 of those working directly on the CubeSat. There's other projects within that student organization, such as CANSAT competition projects that the students participate in as well.
And are you the only faculty member that's supervising this?
There is a faculty member in the ECE department, Dr. Pablo Gomez, who is co-mentoring with me.
How long do you anticipate your operations on orbit will go on for, and how long do you need to accomplish your mission?
So due to limitations of the spacecraft, we can only fire for 6 minutes at a time before we have to recharge the batteries. So we are looking to operate the thruster until failure, or until it runs out of propellant, and we're expecting that to take about 24 hours total operations time. So do the math.
So 240 pulses or something like that, huh?
Yes.
Okay. So what is the lifetime of the spacecraft on orbit? So you launch, presumably some kind of initial checkout of some sort. You make the ACS system stabilize the attitude. Now you're ready to go into normal mode where you're going to actually perform these experiments. How long then?
We're expecting it to be about a 5-month mission. But that's very arbitrary. It really, we're going to have to look once we get on orbit and determine how long it takes to charge the batteries. We can predict these things, but nothing ever happens exactly as you expect.
Are there any components that are particularly sensitive that you're worried about for that 5-month period of time?
The onboard computer, we are using just a BeagleBone Black, so we're not using a radiation-hardened OBC. So we are a little bit worried about that, and as well as any memory storage devices. Those tend to be affected by radiation the most.
Do you think that charging the spacecraft up in any way mitigates the risk of radiation?
I do not think that charging the spacecraft up mitigates any radiation risk. In fact, I think charging the spacecraft up is going to cause other issues and potential spacecraft failure, which would be a mission success as it is, because we will know we cannot operate in single polarity mode.
Will this be the first demonstration of this single polarity thruster?
As far as I know, yes.
So that's a big deal. I mean, it's exciting that CubeSat can accomplish that. Do you think this is a pathfinder for another flight demonstration, maybe larger scale?
I think since the goal of this type of a propulsion system would be for CubeSats, for the most part, I don't necessarily see a larger mission. Maybe a larger CubeSat, maybe an extended mission, but no, nothing huge, no big spacecraft.
Well, sorry for a naive question here, but we were talking about using electrospray with ionic liquids. And notionally, you say that the thruster switches polarity back and forth and alternately expels part of the molecule that's charged one way or the other, right? So sometimes you charge and expel positive, sometimes you charge and expel negative. Does that mean that some of the propellant is left behind during that period of time? Like, does this become some kind of imbalance in the amount of, let's say, positively or negatively charged material in the propellant?
Exactly. And that is what causes the propellant to degrade, which will cause a reduction in the performance of the thruster. So a reduction in thruster efficiency and potentially a reduction in thrust.
So if that's happening, then again, just a naive question, I don't quite understand this technology. When you're accelerating one species or one sort of half of the molecule, I guess, and the other half just stays behind, does that mean at the end of the mission, you just have 50% of your liquid just kind of hanging out on the spacecraft?
Ideally, it would be 50%, but it's likely going to be a significantly higher percentage of the propellant.
Because some of it will have degraded, I guess? And
yes.
I see. So then I guess, would it make any sense if you had that kind of alternating scheme which I guess you don't have, but then you could maybe fire all of that stuff as a second phase of the mission. Would that make any sense?
So what will happen when you take away just one of the cations or anions is I think it causes a fundamental chemical reaction within the propellant.
Oh, I see. So what's the advantage of using only a single polarity?
The advantage is a simplification of the electrical circuit that operates the thruster. So in a traditional operation, you have to have something capable of doing a high voltage switching from up to 2,000 volts positive to 2,000 volts negative. Ideally, we're not operating at that high of a potential, but some propellants require that. Without having to do that switching, that eliminates failure modes within the power processing unit and also demonstrates that if there is a failure mode and your system is stuck on one polarity or the other, you could potentially continue to operate your spacecraft in a limited fashion.
Is there some kind of technology development opportunity focused on the propellant itself? I mean, could you imagine a research goal which would be devising a propellant that really only is cations, for example?
So there is work in the area of propellant development to create a propellant that is less susceptible to degradation. I don't know if we'll ever be able to get one that is not at all susceptible to degradation. It's just the nature of that type of ionic liquid.
I wonder if we could talk about some of the high power electric propulsion work that you're involved in. I know you're a member of the Janus Institute. Can you tell us about NASA's Janus Research Institute and what you do and what the Institute more broadly hopes to accomplish?
So Janus stands for the Joint Advanced Propulsion Institute. How do you like that one?
I think the acronym is sketchily related to the name.
There's no P in it for propulsion. Okay, so JANA stands for the Joint Advanced Propulsion Institute, and it is a NASA STRI, so Space Technology Research Institute. It is led by Georgia Tech and the University of Michigan, Professor Mitchell Walker and Ben Jorns, respectively, with affiliated universities across the country. The goal of the JANA Institute is to help NASA determine how to test very high-powered electric propulsion systems, specifically Hall effect thrusters and gridded ion thrusters. So NASA's goal of sending humans to Mars and other grand missions to the outer planets will require very high-powered electric propulsion systems, upwards of 100 kilowatts or more. Currently, the highest-powered Hall effect thruster that NASA has tested extensively is the Advanced Electric Propulsion System that's going to be on the Gateway, the Lunar Gateway, that operates at about 13 kilowatts. So we're talking orders of magnitude higher power. The issue is, we do not have facilities to test those types of thrusters on the ground. The vacuum facilities that we are required to test these thrusters in have to pump out the gas, so the xenon or the krypton or the argon that these thrusters are operating with. And even if we covered every surface within the vacuum facility with cryopanels to pump out the gas, we would still not be able to pump the amount that we're putting in. The high powered of the thruster, the high powered operation, will cause heat, which could overheat the cryopanels that pump out the xenon. Additionally, the flux of ions will cause sputtering from the chamber walls, which can then deposit on the thruster itself, which masks the thruster lifetime that could be limited by erosion. So Janus, the goal of Janus is to figure out how to do testing that we can do on the ground and extrapolate that into models so that we can predict thruster lifetime on orbit.
What is your role as a member of the Institute? Is there one particular part of that problem that Western is focusing on?
So the Institute is broken up into three pillars. There is the facility effects testing pillar, and that is mostly being done at Georgia Tech and the University of Michigan because they have very large vacuum facilities. There is a modeling pillar, and that is led by Dr. Richard Wirtz at Oregon State University. And then there is the fundamental studies pillar, and that is led by Dr. Josh Rovey at the University of Illinois and Dr. John Williams at Colorado State University. At Western Michigan University, we are a member of the Fundamental Studies pillar, and we are developing diagnostics to test these thrusters so that we can input data from thrusters into the models to help calibrate models.
Are you guys developing a totally new diagnostic for this approach or adapting existing diagnostics?
We are adapting existing diagnostics for use. One of the diagnostics that we're developing is a confinement cage to adjust the electrical grounding condition of vacuum facilities. So one of the big issues with testing within a vacuum chamber is that there is an alternative path to ground for electrons within the system. And this alternative path to ground can give misleading information on how the thruster is actually operating.
So this is alternative in the sense that normally you'd expect the body of the spacecraft would be the ground.
Yes.
And as opposed to the walls of the chamber that it's in.
Usually the electrons that are expelled from the spacecraft will neutralize the plume of the spacecraft. So the goal is to emit ions. If we're just emitting ions, then yes, we would again charge up our spacecraft. So we have electrons that we're also emitting in these types of thrusters, different from the electrospray thrusters. And so those electrons are emitted at the same charge as the ions to neutralize that plume. So if we are providing alternative paths to ground, we might be emitting more electrons. We might be, again, sending those electrons back to the spacecraft. They're just going somewhere where they can't go in space. There's no ground in space.
Does that get any better with a larger and larger chamber?
Yes, that will get better with a bigger chamber. However, it's always going to be an issue. There's always going to be that path to ground through the chamber walls.
So how does the confinement cage help solve that problem?
So what we've developed is based on a diagnostic that was developed by the Air Force Research Lab, and it is a metal mesh cage that we can charge to different potentials. It is floating within the vacuum chamber. It's mesh so that the neutral gas and ions can leave the cage and not artificially increase the pressure within, while the electrons can be measured by biasing the cage to different potentials. So we can bias that cage either negatively, we can make it floating, or we can bias it positively, and we can measure the effect on thruster performance.
When you say it's floating in the chamber, you mean, of course, electrically floating, so it's not mechanically floating. I just say this because not everybody following this is an electrical engineer. So.
Yeah, no, I get okay. It. Right. Yes, electrically floating. So it is isolated from ground.
Gotcha.
You said there's a second diagnostic?
Yes, the second diagnostic is a high-speed retarding potential energy analyzer to resolve the oscillations in the ion energies of particles leaving the Hall thruster. So the ions leave at an average energy, but there are oscillations within that, and those oscillations occur at frequencies ranging between 20 kilohertz up to the megahertz range. We have been able to resolve features in ions extracted at frequencies up to 80 kilohertz.
And so why is that important to find out?
So understanding these oscillations is important to inputting expected ion energies into the calibrated models for understanding thruster lifetime. And these oscillations can cause degradations in thruster efficiency and in extreme conditions can cause thruster wear.
So this testing environment, really, it's trying to test every aspect of the electric thruster. So performance, for sure, right? Degradation, I guess. So is there a list of goals for this testing? It seems like it's pretty broad. You're interested in degradation. You're interested in thruster performance. Is there kind of a shopping list that NASA is interested in acquiring from this?
There are specific goals of the program. One is to mitigate the effect of sputtered material from the chamber walls. So in that respect, institutions are working on understanding the sputtering and potentially how to mitigate sputtering from chamber walls. We are also looking to understand the effects of background pressure on the thruster operation. So the higher the thruster power, the more mass flow through the thruster, that's going to result in a higher background pressure. And that can affect thruster operation as well and performance. So we're looking to understand exactly how that happens. And we are also looking to understand the electrical facility effects. So how the grounded walls affect thruster operation as you go to higher and higher thruster power levels. Those are kind of the three main areas in which we're looking. And so the diagnostics that we're developing are going to be used to measure thruster properties in different operating conditions, both electrical and facility pressure operating conditions. And then those data can be fed into the physics models to predict lifetime.
So it sounds like a problem that arises because of our inability to model the space environment perfectly on Earth, right? There's so many things like that. There's so many ways in which we would wish we could, say, model zero gravity or model a perfect hard vacuum or all sorts of other things we just can't do. Do you think this is a candidate, an explanation or a justification for why we might want to do testing in space? You know, in the future that's coming up, access to space will be so much less expensive. Ideally, with SpaceX's Starship, there's a proliferation of launch vehicles beyond that that maybe offer more frequent access to space. There are prospects of in-orbit, let's say, labs or manufacturing facilities, things like the orbital reef and a variety of other ideas where you could maybe build and test things in place. Do you think that there are some problems that are just nearly intractable, difficult to solve to the point where maybe it's better overall to try to do it in space as opposed to do it on the ground?
Partly, yes. The high power operation, the background pressure issues, and the sputtered material would all be mitigated by operating in space. However, there is still a fundamental issue that NASA has with thruster lifetime. These thrusters operate and are expected to operate for tens of thousands of hours. Traditionally, NASA does a one-to-one testing. So for every hour of operation in space, they want to test it on the ground for that amount of time. And so for something that is expected to operate for 20,000 hours in space, that's 20,000 hours of ground testing or in space testing.
So years and years.
Years and years. So another goal of Janus is to be able to shorten the lifetime tests that NASA requires.
And how would you propose to do that?
By increasing the fidelity of the physics-based models, we can decrease the time required to test a thruster
okay,
on the ground.
Okay, so you test out the things to the point where you're now confident in your computer models, then you can run an accelerated model in a virtual environment.
Yes.
And conclude something from that.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
You're a member of the board of directors of the Electric Rocket Propulsion Society, the first female member in the board's history. Can you tell us about what the Electric Rocket Propulsion Society does?
The Electric Rocket Propulsion Society is a group of like-minded individuals interested in electric propulsion systems for spacecraft. We gather every other year at the International Electric Propulsion Conference to share our research and camaraderie and interact with each other. The board of directors oversees that group, and we plan for future conference locations and try to help facilitate these conversations and collaborations.
So how many people are working on electric rockets around the world?
At the last International Electric Propulsion Conference, which occurred in 2002, we had about 500 attendees. Prior to COVID in 2019, we had about 800 attendees.
Well, let me ask a question about electric rockets. You say electric rockets. When I think of a rocket, I think of something that lifts off of the Earth. And is that really what you're talking about? Or are we talking about propulsion systems that are used really in space as opposed to for, you know, millions of newtons of thrust?
Yeah. So electric rockets or electric propulsion systems operate in space. The highest power system that has ever been measured was a 100 kilowatt Hall effect thruster that operated at 5 newtons, very short period of time of about 5 minutes.
So if that system weighed maybe 500 grams, you could lift off the surface of the Earth, but I suspect it didn't weigh that little.
Correct. The thruster was very, very large. So these are for in-space propulsion systems only, in addition to the fact that these systems need a vacuum environment to operate. Otherwise, the ions will be immediately neutralized by the surrounding atmosphere.
Let me ask you, what first got you excited about electric propulsion as a field of study?
I didn't even know electric propulsion exists until I went to college, and a professor at my university was an expert and had a research lab. And I had him in my freshman engineering class, Professor Alec Gallimore, and he sparked my interest in electric propulsion. He introduced the class to it, and his excitement about it was infectious. And from then on, I was hooked, and I ended up doing my PhD under his guidance.
So did you start working on it as an undergrad or wait until you got to your PhD?
I joined the lab as a senior undergraduate student.
What were the first projects that you worked on?
The first project that I worked on was a diagnostic development project, and that's where I am today.
Wow.
Developing diagnostics.
Clearly, that spark of inspiration from Alec Gallimore had a big impact on you. What advice would you give to people just beginning their careers in this area?
I think it's really important to find a mentor that you can work with. Electric propulsion is such a niche field that the courses that you take at university in aerospace engineering, even in spacecraft propulsion, are very limited input into electric propulsion. So if you do find that you're interested in it, you need to find yourself a good mentor to get you excited about it, to get you to learn about it, and to get you involved in it.
So do you think that this field, electric propulsion, are there enough open problems to appeal to students and researchers for the foreseeable future? I mean, it feels like there's so many open questions that there's an inexhaustible supply of things to work on.
There are a lot of open questions, and there is a lot of research topics available, from NASA's high-powered interests to the Air Force's interest in reusable spacecraft and refillable spacecraft. Having a spacecraft that you can refill its propellant on orbit is going to be operating with a different propellant than a compressed gas like xenon. So there's a lot of issues with which types of propellants are going to be used in the future. In addition, there's the opportunity of having nuclear reactors on orbit, which is very exciting for electric propulsion because we can start operating at very high powers in the 100 kilowatt to megawatt range, rather than being limited by solar panels.
Is that sort of the holy grail of the discipline, you know, a certain level of high power?
Not necessarily, because there's also miniaturization. So the miniaturization of spacecraft with the CubeSat boom is also very exciting, because different technologies such as the electrospray thruster technology miniaturize much better than, say, a Hall thruster or a gridded ion engine. So miniaturization is also very exciting.
So the challenge for propulsion in general is something like you get to have high efficiency, low thrust, or high thrust, low efficiency. And it's hard to get both at the same time. And by high thrust, I mean, you know, chemical propulsion will give you as many meganewtons as you want. But in efficiency, if you speak in specific impulse, ISP, that's, you know, a few hundred seconds probably is typical for chemical propulsion. And then for ion propulsion, again, very tiny levels of thrust, a newton or two if you're lucky in electropropulsion. But the efficiency is quite high. So again, in terms of specific impulse, that's several thousand seconds probably. I'm not sure what the upper limit is these days. I'm sure you guys have a number that you would be able to offer. But do you see a technology that's going to span that divide? Is there an electric propulsion approach that can also give you high thrust for the mass?
There is a technology that has been researched since the early days of electric propulsion, 1950s, 1960s, called magnetoplasma dynamic thrusters, MPDs. And this technology is theoretically, I think, the highest thrust to power that you can get out of an electric propulsion device that's been invented. They operate very poorly at lower powers. And so the push to have higher power availability on orbit has re-sparked the desire to research MPD thrusters.
With our conventional approach to electric propulsion, even if it's things that are not fully developed like MPDs, the only way to get more thrust is more power. So there's no free extra thrust without putting more power into the system. So you can get high ISP and high thrust if you have a lot of electrical power available, maybe from a nuclear power source.
I don't think we're ever going to get meganewtons, though.
Yeah, I guess you could calculate how much power that would be, but probably more than is projected anytime soon.
Gigawatts.
Sure. Well, I think the range of open problems, the excitement that comes from being able to develop a new rocket technology, I mean, all those are great ways to bring people into the discipline. I think a lot of students, at least, are really excited about the prospect of making a difference, of being able to cross a threshold that no one else has crossed to, you know, develop something that no one else has thought of yet. It's an exciting field to be in.
Yeah, it's really exciting. There's a lot of interest in the field in general. And SpaceX launching all of these Hall thrusters has brought an enormous amount of attention to the field of electric propulsion. In addition, NASA's new space station, the Lunar Gateway, will have electric propulsion on board as its main propulsion source. And so it's just a really exciting time to be involved.
We want to thank you again for coming to talk to us about your work. And we wish you the best of luck with the PEP-GS launch. And we look forward to watching its progress and learning what it tells us about electric spray thrusters.
Thank you.
Well, I'm excited to hear that Christine is taking on some space technology research through a technology demonstration mission. You know, it's a thing that does happen at universities sometimes, that we can take our research into space and try it out in a realistic environment. In fact, the specific environment of space, that makes a big difference. It clearly establishes credibility for the idea, but also maybe teaches us some things we wouldn't have discovered if it was just pencil or paper or something done in a lab. That's exciting.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it broadens our area of knowledge from just being subject matter experts to really functioning more like systems engineers and understanding better how our subsystem, which in our case is the propulsion system, integrates with the rest of the spacecraft.
It's a key aspect of technology that you really can't stay in a silo very successfully. You do need to integrate other aspects of things going around the core technology, at least what you think of as the core technology. Otherwise, it's likely to fail in some way or certainly be less effective than it could be. So yeah, I'm excited to see what happens with this single polarity electrospray demo.
I guess their goal is for it to fail at some point. So it'll be exciting to see how long they can make it last.
It's kind of genius that you can construct an experiment around a failure, right? Like once it's failed, you've succeeded. So I got to come up with a way to do that in my own work.
Yeah, props to Christina and her team and good luck with your future research. Mason Peck is a Stephen J. Fujikawa Professor of Astronautics at Cornell University.
Elaine Petro is an assistant professor in mechanical and aerospace engineering.
Spaceflight Mechanics is recorded at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, with funding from the Sibley School of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering.
Our sound engineer and editor is Claire Peck, with music by Cosmoptera.